והינו עם אדוני אלוהינו עלינו מעשה דנו וכוננה עלינו מעשה דנו וכוננהו. שלום עליכם, ברוכים הבאים. Welcome everyone as we continue our shiurim in Sefer Hilchot Yesodei Torah of Rabbeinu HaRambam. We're beginning now the second chapter. And in tonight's lesson, we're going to learn three different laws. We're going to learn about the love and fear of God. And again, we've got to put that in the context of remembering what exactly is God. We're going to learn about contemplating these things. And then we're going to introduce the concept of other forms of life. And we're going to introduce the topic of those forms that we so generically refer to as angels. So that's pretty much what we're going to cover now. And you're going to see how all of these three actually merge into a singular whole. So therefore, this lesson is about contemplation, thinking, feeling, experiencing, and seeing the greater picture of things. Not as an academic or philosophical pursuit, but as an experiential pursuit. The second chapter, Rambam, after describing the nature of the primordial existence, its parameters and its nature as being something so comprehensively abstract and beyond the construct of human fantasy and imagination. Yes, in our fantasies and imagination, we somehow envision the ultimate divine consciousness of the universe to be somehow a superhuman being. We talk about God as if he is a king, a ruler, a lord, and we interact in our stories as if he is, if you will, like one of us. That is all well and good to express moral stories at a very fundamental level. But a point that Rambam makes very, very clearly, he documents in his introduction to the Mishnaic commentary of Sanhedrin, I believe the 11th chapter, how important it is that we recognize this symbolic language of our sages. Like the biblical prophets before them, our Torah, our rabbinic sages of the Mishnah and the Gemara, used traditional Semitic metaphorical symbolic language to help us understand and relate to abstract realities in a way that a simple mind can understand. The purpose, of course, is not for us to remain in our simplicity. That would be imprisonment. But rather, to help us take the step from one level to the next in our maturation process in experiencing and knowing spirituality. So, this second chapter, Rambam declares in the single law, Ha'el ha-nichbad ha-nora ha-zeh mitzvah le-ahavo ul-yir'a-oto. This El, which we call God, which he says here is honorable and awesome, it is a commandment to love and fear him, as it is written, the laws we all know so well, Ve'ahavta Hashem Elohecha, to love the Lord your God, and also et Hashem Elohecha tirah, and God your Lord should you fear. Now, what exactly are you loving and fearing? What is the definition of love and fear? Now, I follow the English translation of the word yirah, to fear, but it actually means to be in awe, to realize, if you will, a greater concept. We, again, in our mythological thinking, believe that love is supposed to be some emotional feeling of coziness and warmth and happiness and giddiness, kind of, if you will, like teenage infatuation. That's not love. Any of us who are mature recognize and know that love has nothing to do with that. For married couples who have been married for decades, these are the people who truly know and understand what is love. Because love isn't so much what you feel, it's what you do. It reminds me of the old Fiddler on the Roof Broadway play, I believe, where in which the character Tevye sung a song to his wife, "Do you love me?" He says, "Do I what? Do you love me?" She answers, "For 25 years, as long as they're married, I cooked your meals, I mended your clothes, I cleaned your house," and ultimately concluded and said, "If that's not love, then what is?" And ultimately, in truth, that is what love is. Love isn't what you feel. Love is what you do. Love is a sense of commitment. Love is a sense of a desire to do the right things. That is love. So therefore, if you wake up one morning and you look at your spouse and you don't have that feeling of teenage giddiness and infatuation, that doesn't mean you don't love your spouse. When you get out of bed and your spouse might need your help, you help around the house, cook a meal, do whatever, that's love. That's what it is, the kindness that we show, the respect and the honor that we show. That is love. That is true love. How do I cultivate that type of desire towards something so abstract as like universal consciousness? I mean, how do I even connect it to? I mean, it doesn't seem to be a relationship. I understand how to show all of these things I've just described to another human being. I can show them to my country, to my religion, to my community, all the more so, of course, to my family. How do I describe it to this primordial existence which we just described as God? Very interesting question that even our sages ourselves have asked. Right? We say that God is a devouring fire. And one of the commandments is to bond with God. They say, how do you bond with a devouring fire? I mean, it's just doesn't sound logical. Prior to my answering the question, which Rambam himself will in our second law, let's first define fear. Awe, as I describe it. Fear and awe isn't this sense of trembling, like you're standing in front of the judge who has now had you arrested for inappropriate reasons. In olden times in other countries, some claim even today in Western countries, people are sometimes arrested under false and trumped up charges, and they are therefore subject to a trial and a judgment whose conclusions are pre-evident. And such a person would stand there knowing what's coming down the pike, and they're shaking in their boots. This is not the fear of God. God is not a human being. God is not a human judge. God's not going to take you and crumble you up and throw you out like garbage. The fear of God, the awe of God, is a sense of recognition of the eminence of the real power that exists and our subjugation to it. Now, I'll give you a good example. I, as a human being, am in awe and fear, if you will, of the laws of gravity. If I were to be standing on top of a very high building, I really would not want to tempt the law of gravity by jumping off the building to decide maybe the laws aren't so strict and maybe they could be lenient, and maybe instead of me plopping down 10 stories and smashing myself to death on the street below, maybe I'd kind of like just float along the way. We all know that's ridiculous. That's silly. I have a healthy respect for the law of gravity. I have a healthy respect for the parameters and boundaries of all natural law. I am not going to stand and play in the middle of traffic and say, God will provide. And then, of course, the next thing is you get hit by a truck. You don't stand and play in traffic. We don't act in ways which we know are dangerous. If I turn on the fire on my stove and I have a flame burning, I'm not going to say, oh, how pretty it is. I want to touch it because I know it will burn me, and that is dangerous. I am in awe or fear of the flame. I respect its parameters and its dangers. When it comes to approaching the universe and all that God has created, this is the fear of God. The knowledge and the recognition of the parameters of existence. We have lost these things today. People think that they can do anything and everything is okay, and no consequences for behavior simply because there is no concept anymore of morality. Morality is as much a natural law as is any other law in nature. And when we violate the laws of morality, we are subject to consequences of natural law as much as we had violated the laws of gravity, the laws of fire, and the laws of any other danger in the natural world. We don't see it, or so we say, but yet we do see it. We just deny what it is that we see. So then, the great question, how do I get to see it? How do I get to know? How do I get to this level of consciousness that this love and fear, as properly defined, is something that I integrate into my daily reality? Let's put it bluntly. How do I fulfill the mitzvot of the commandments of Torah to love and fear God? How do I do it? I love you, God. Oh, I love you, love you, love you. Please. You sound, people talk like that. I'm sorry. Forgive me. No. You don't even have to. It sounds very idiotic when you talk like that. All right? That's not love. I fear you, Lord. It's just as ridiculous and idiotic. Okay? Those are projections of fantasies. That is not the reality of the experience. Go back into your stories from the Tanakh, our Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. You can read in the Gemara the stories of our great sages. They embodied the love and fear in the proper practical ways, as Rambam himself is now going to describe. The second law asks the question, how are we supposed to love and fear him? And his answer is this, b'sha'ah she'it bonen ha'adam b'ma'asav u'b'ra'av ha'niflaim ha'gedolim v'yira'ah mehen hochmato. He says, in the hour at the time when a person is going to contemplate, okay? Contemplate. Hitbonen is actually a form of meditation. All of the great deeds and the wondrous great creations, immediately you will have yir'ah. Again, interestingly how the translation here translates that here as appreciates. Yir'ah me'en ochmato. When you have this meditative contemplation of nature and see all the profundities of the natural world, you will recognize in it the wisdom. You will come to a healthy respect of the boundaries of the laws of nature, as I described. And here, Rambam says that is the fear of God. And he says again, She'ein la erech velo ketz, that the wisdom, the profundity of nature, has no measurable limitation and no end.
When you recognize the profundity of all this, immediately you will come to love, to praise, and to wonder, and to desire, it says here, with great passion, to know His great name. Just like he says here, according to David HaMelech, Tzama nafshi l'Elohim l'Elchai. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. Now these words are not just metaphor. What Rambam here is saying is an important concept. It is not enough that we just accept an academic principle. He wants us to go out and meditate, contemplate, think about these things, explore, study, learn to what we today call the sciences, what our sages in the Gemara referred to as the chokhmaot, the wisdoms of the world, which included things like math, astronomy, all the traditional sciences, physics, even chemistry. You will see such profundities, such wisdom, such awe, that you sit there and you go, wow, this is deep stuff. Creation is deep. Most physicists today who are honest and not proclaiming their own fundamentalist atheistic agenda acknowledge that there is some order to the universe. They will call it God, but of course their definition of God is far beyond the mythological, fantasaical form that is embraced by many religions and religious people today. They recognize that there is a cosmic consciousness. They don't necessarily want to apply it to religion because of all the social and political problems. But it's interesting that modern atheistic science, in its discovery of the profundities of the reality of the universe, are actually doing more to break down the walls of idolatry and mythological religion than traditional religion itself is doing. They're showing people the foolishness of the fantasies and the nature of the realities. Rambam knew this. Our sages have always known this. We must contemplate and learn. Truly the way of a Ben Torah is to learn the ways of science. Even concepts such as Charles Darwin's theory, and I emphasize the word theory, that means an idea, a belief, not a proven statement, of evolution. You may have the likes of the great Rabbi Avraham Yitzhak Kook, Alav Shalom, who stated that evolution is not necessarily contradictory to Torah at all. Why should it be? In the Torah itself, God spoke of creation as occurring in an evolutionary progressive fashion. Day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, etc. Which just so happens to follow what we know as the scientific genealogical pattern of the development of life. Pretty progressive for Moshe Rabbeinu to have known that 3,300 plus years ago. I don't know where he could have learned it from, if not from another higher intelligence. But those wish to claim today that Darwin says that this evolutionary process happened randomly, haphazardly, without any direction. I believe that has been mathematically proven to be impossible. That if we take the number of possible possibilities and ascribe to each possibility like a micron, a multiple of a second, and look at all these possibilities that were necessary to get together to create life in its present form, we wouldn't have enough time in the 16 billion years since the Big Bang for all those possibilities to have occurred to have created life in the structure that we have today. So that's how I've heard it described from statisticians and mathematicians. We all know that there's something profound to the nature, to the construct of reality. As I mentioned to you earlier, and I'll mention again, our sages have taught that in the beginning God looked into the Torah and created the world. That means that the entire world, our entire universe, exists in the Torah. And therefore, by definition, the Torah exists within all the universe, anywhere and everywhere. Our Torah teaches this when we recite the Pasuk, Malo Kola Aretz Kavodo. You remember the words of the angels who state, the whole world is full of God's glory, God's presence, God's essence. Everywhere, in everything, even in good and even in evil, is the higher presence, this primordial existence. Everything is connected to it and through it. And if you cannot learn about the ways of Torah, the ways of the Creator, through studying in a book, then close your book and open your eyes and open your heart to contemplate. Go out into nature. Go out and see and learn. And you will come with an open mind and an open heart to see how the Creator is in the air you breathe, in the water you drink, in the nature of your own flesh, in the nature of the world around you, in the nature of the world inside you. This is not a matter of faith. This is a matter of knowledge. Rambam here does not say la'amin, which is the Hebrew word for faith. He says leda, to know. And interestingly, one of the great things that drive modern science and drives the heart of the truly spiritual is the wanting and the desire to know more. Why is it like this? What does it mean? What is it connected? It is one of the most fundamental principles that define humanity. We are by definition a curious species. We want to know so much more. Indeed, whenever something happens, for good or for bad, if something good happens, you say, gee, what did I do to deserve this? You're seeking knowledge. And God forbid if something terrible happens, we say the same thing, what did I do to deserve this? As if such knowledge would make you feel better. Of course it would not. But yet, this is what we ask. Why? What difference does it make why? The difference is because we're curious. We want to know. And somehow in knowledge comes comfort. Somehow information brings revelation. And this is not information that is academic in nature that I just read from a book. I read a line in a book, okay, this is what my religion says. I believe it, I accept it because I'm a religious guy. No, that's not what we're talking about here. When the Torah commands us, you shall love Hashem, the next words are, with all your heart. It never says with all your head. And these words which I command you this day shall be upon your heart. It does not say in your head, in your mind. Do not translate the Hebrew word lev as mind or head. That is a mistranslation. It is incorrect and wrong. The meaning is comprehensively different, as in my opinion, I believe, should be glaringly clear from every mention of the Hebrew word lev found throughout the entire Tanakh. David HaMelech was such a pursuer when he states, my soul thirsts for God, for the living God, not the God of a book, not the God of philosophy, but the reality of it, the true flowing experience of it. Torah was always a living experience. Indeed, though we have the written book of the Torah, our sages have known since the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, the word in and of itself was almost understandable. Couldn't grasp or fathom it unless you had what we called the oral Torah. Many of the mitzvot and the commandments God says to do, but he never defines how to do it. God says in the Torah, you have to observe the Shabbat. And if you violate the laws of the Shabbat, biblical times, you would have been subject to the death penalty. Now, if I was living in the days of the wilderness, and I heard Moshe Rabbeinu ordain that law, my first question would be, gee, I don't want to be subject to death. What is it that I have to do? What do I have to avoid doing in order to observe the Shabbat properly? I would have asked my elders. The elders would have asked Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu would have taught Bnei Israel. But none of that was written down. That was oral Torah. And Moshe taught the elders, and the elders taught those who took over for them, and passed down from generation to generation to generation to generation. That is how we learn what we today call halakha. And halakha doesn't mean law. It means the way. The natural flow and way of Torah, which exists inside each and every one of us. Remember, God looked into the Torah and created the universe, including us. Therefore, we are in the Torah, and the Torah is within us. Remember that reflection, because it is the foundation of true knowing. This oral Torah was alive. It flowed with the life and the spirit of the people. When it came to a point of crisis, when it was in danger of being forgotten, the man who would have been the king of Israel, if there were a king in his day, but yet he was only a prince instead of a king, Rabbi Yehuda, of the great and holy line of the house of David, we called him Hanasi, ordained by his authority that the oral law should be committed to writing so as to preserve it for future generations. And his decision was highly controversial, dangerous, feared that by putting it into a rigid form, it would lose its fluid motion, and therefore it would become subject to misunderstanding. And since the days of Rabbi Yehuda, for hundreds of years, many traditions arose around the Mishnah. Until many years later, one of the great sages, again guided by the Spirit of Heaven, had to put together a body of literature that taught the mind how to flow like the living flow of the river. And of course, I'm referring to the Gemara. And for those who study the Gemara, we do not learn it to learn the laws. Because the Gemara itself says, Masechet Nidah, Daf Zayin, if I'm not mistaken, if not Daf Vav, Eino lomdim halacha mipi Gemara. We don't learn halacha from the Gemara. The Gemara is there to help us understand things. The Gemara goes into a discussion and goes on to tangent upon tangent, flows into stories and then back to discussions of law, and you have this give and take, right and left, up and down, in and out, flow. And the reason why the Gemara goes like that is to teach the mind how to flow, how to think, how to contemplate. And that is why we study these things. It is not here to teach us the law. You have to learn halakha for that. It is here to teach us how to experience. That is the beauty of Gemara study. And woe to those rabbis who do not teach this, because then they are not teaching Gemara correctly. When you truly can close your eyes and recognize the wisdom in a Gemara class and see its reflection in the flow of a river, in the shape and movement of the breeze upon the hills, when you can take a walk into the woods or into the desert and hear reflected in your mind and see reflected before you the words of Rabbi Yehuda or Rav Ashi, then you will have seen the Torah. Then you will fulfill where it says, the world is full of His glory. Then you will know, and that means you will love, and that means you will have awe and fear, and you will have fulfilled these laws. That and this is the nature of these things. So Rambam continues and says, "Vekeshe mechashev bedevarim ha'elu asman." When you contemplate and think about these things, miyad hu nirtal achorav b'yichad. Immediately, you're going to like recoil, if you will. You're going to take a step back, and you're going to be afraid. V'yadu shehu b'riyaketana shfela. You're going to recognize just how small and insignificant we are. None of this great philosophy of how great we are and how profound we are. You're going to recognize your humanity, the limitation and the frailty of our mortality. That if you do, in your foolishness, stand as part of that truck, you are going to get hit and die. That if you truly want to challenge the laws of gravity and jump, you're going to fall and kill yourself. If you want to put your hand in the fire, you're going to get burned. We are so human in every mortal and frail definition of what that means. It's not here talking about our great grandiose souls. Only God knows about that. Therefore, afilo amedet betat kalam ota lifnei tamim deot. You must recognize that we stand here, if you will, with limited, simplistic knowledge. It says tamim deot, simplistic, simple knowledge. All right, tamim deot. God is the simplicity of the universe, and this is what we try to understand. How limited we are in comparison to what is. David HaMelech states, Ki reshamecha ma'aseh espotecha. He says, I look upon your heavens, the work of your finger. Ma'enosh ki tiskarenu. What therefore is a man that you would think about him? You know, there are millions, hundreds of millions of stars in our solar system and hundreds of millions of stars in our galaxy and hundreds of millions of galaxies in the known universe. And that's only in this one singular universe. And here we are, one of present, about a billion human beings on the face of the earth. Boy, oh boy, God's got a lot to keep in track of. How significant, therefore, can I be? Oh, we are the great! Yes, say all the words that you want. Alright? Believe whatever you want. But just recognize where we are in the greater context of things. I guarantee you, there are races of entities in the universe far, far older than man. We're going to learn about them as we continue now. Far older. Many who are even closer to God than we are now. Whether we like that or not, we have a significance and a uniqueness, that's true, but everything does. We must recognize in our present mortal state just how limited we are in this greater grandiose universe. Look out at the stars at night. Look how small we are. And therefore, in relationship to the primordial existence, recognize just how small we are. Humble yourself thereby, by recognizing the reality of truth. Submit, surrender. And say, I have desires, wants, and needs. I have attitudes. I think that the whole world should be created in my image. People should do what I say because I'm so smart and I'm so right. I know nothing. I know nothing. I see nothing. I am so insignificant. I am so small. God, I turn to you and I thank you for every breath. For the fact that I'm able to open and close my eyes, I'm even able to see or hear or talk. I thank you for existence itself. And I acknowledge, accept, and proclaim that everything in existence is you. I am part of that. And I only ask that my arrogance, my limited mind, doesn't get in the way of me being a vehicle and a vessel to shining your life, your light, your essence. This is the true surrender. This is the love and the pure of which we talk. This is the ultimate conclusion of these contemplations. Ein od milivado. There's nothing other than God. We learned that earlier. This is the ultimate reality of our connection to the greater universe. This is what we must focus on and understand. Ulefi adevarim ha'elu. Ani mevarech klalim gedolim. Rambam now is introducing to us what he's going to do next. From these concepts here that he's talking about, he wants to explain to us some great and general rules about all the deeds of the Master of the Universe. Kedishu petach lamevin lahovet Hashem, so that we might have an opening to understanding that will lead us to develop this love of God, this awareness that I speak of. Komo shamru hachamim binyan ahava, like our sages spoke with this aspect of loving. Shemitoch kach atamakir et mi shamar v'haya olam. Because it's from these contemplations you will come to understand and recognize the one who spoke and brought the universe into being. That's what this is all about. It's not a statement of faith. It's a statement of reality. It's a statement of experience. It's an experience of knowledge, of knowing. And now Rambam is going to introduce to us something about life. He says, Kol ma shebara HaKadosh Baruch Hu bo'olamo n'halak l'shlosha halakim. Everything that God created in existence exists in one of three categories. Number one, Mehen beruim shehem mechubarim megolem v'tzora. We have those creations which are existence of, if you will, matter and form, spirit and form, body and soul, if you will, force and form. Golem, of course, is the Hebrew word for form, structure, body. And tzora, it's kind of like its inner essence, its inner spiritual form. V'hem hovim v'nifsadim tamid. They exist, and then they cease to exist continuously. There's this process, a continual state of transference from one form to the other, born and dying, existing and non-existing. And he gives examples. Kamo gufot ha'adam v'habehemot v'tzemachim v'metichot. Such as the bodies of human beings and animals and plants. And he even states metals. Gee, I don't know that I would say that about metals as I do the human body. But this introduces us to a very important concept that we must understand in this description as well as everywhere else in Rambam. Maimonides wrote these words in around what we know as the 1100s, 1200s. Okay? He was a scientist, educated in the science of his day. And he understood science as was understood in his day by everybody else. And many of those scientific concepts, as described here, reflect a knowledge which was accepted then, which today we may have a different understanding. This by no means means that Rambam was wrong, but here he is describing science as it was understood as best as it could, and today our scientists understand things better. And if Rambam was alive today, he would explain things as scientists do today. And if Rambam was alive 100 years from now, then he would describe things as science would describe things 100 years from now, which would make what our scientists today describing be antiquated and old-fashioned. Look at the history of science. Look at where we are today, the beginning of the 21st century. And go back and read scientific statements of the beginning of the 20th century, the beginning of the 19th, 18th, and 17th centuries. Of course, you'll see consistent progression. But yet, you'll see such profound jumps, revelations. Such was true even in Rambam's day. And even though these, he writes here, are laws, he writes these laws to help us understand the nature of loving and fearing God. Those are the laws. And as he states here clearly, what he's now about to describe is how we come to experience that. So whether or not the specific applications of his scientific understandings are accurate by today's standards or not is irrelevant. It's the fundamental issue of why he's doing what he's doing and how we must learn from it. He described now the first level of a body and soul, which is always in a state of constant transference. The second level of this creation, Shehen mechubarim megola metzora are also, if you will, combinations of matter and form, body and soul, kinda. Val einen mishtanin meguf leguf umetzora letzora komo rishonim. And yet this second form does not change from body to body and from form to form like that first category. And he mentions them as, he says, El Tzoratan Kavua Leolam Magalman, Ve'ena Mishtanim Komo Elo. He says their form is rather permanent and they stay in that form and they do not change. And he gives as examples of this the Galgalim, the spheres. The spheres, of course, are the movement and nature of astronomy. V'hakochavim shebehem. And he also defines that as the stars. Now, we know today that stars, if you will, are born and die, just like the first category. Why does Rambam then put stars in the second category? And again, the answer is like I described to you. In Rambam's day, the science of astronomy was not as advanced as it is today. They did not have a Hubble telescope. Rambam's day most likely never saw the birth of a star or a supernova. They had no such concepts. Now, the birth, life, and death of a star follows in its own way, metaphorically, if you will, to the birth, life, and death of a human being. However, I wouldn't compare the 70 to 120 years of a human being to the tens of millions or billions of years of the life of a star. So therefore, in the relative state of things, stars do properly fit into this second category of permanence, even though by modern understanding we recognize that even to that there is a limitation. Umehen biroim, and now he's going to describe a third category. Tzora below golem klal, form, but without a body at all, force, without form, light, necessarily without vessel in that respect. Vehem hamalachim, and they are the angels. Now here is a very interesting introduction. Shehamalachim inam guf v'gavia. He states that angels do not have a body or form. Elet sorot nifradot zomezo. But rather, if you will, essence, tzora, forms, which is separate from one from the other. Now, this is Rambam's fundamental concept, that angels are absolutely and comprehensively non-corporeal and have no corporeal nature whatsoever. I might add that this definition of Rambam was not accepted by all of the sages, especially by many in the Kabbalistic camps. Rambam will enumerate as we proceed different types of angels, 10 different species that we know of at least. We are under the impression that many of these higher species indeed might be non-corporeal, but many of the lowers might be very corporeal indeed. But now this is a problem. Simply because unless you actually meet and know an angel, it's kind of hard to say who and what they are. Think about it like this. If our universe was, as if you will, an artificial construct of reality, kind of like an example of a Hollywood movie made a number of years ago called The Matrix, where in which each of us in reality is a neshama soul, and somehow we put on some type of artificial reality. What's the word that I'm trying to think of here? It's slipping my mind. The virtual realities, that's what it is, yes. Think about it as if your neshama is sitting in heaven and puts on a virtual reality helmet, which becomes life in this world. And life in this world only exists within the context and concept of a virtual reality. And actually, there might be something very real to that. Physics understands now that when you, the position of an atom is actually in a state of movement, state of potential. And it only becomes actual once it is observed. But when it is not observed, who knows what form it takes? Reality takes the construct form that it does because of our perception of it. But beyond our perception, reality is not necessarily what we think it is. Now, if I were to exist outside of this present reality, and I wanted to come into it, I could put on my virtual reality suit and helmet and pop into this world. And for those of us who are here, we would experience such visitors as being as real or unreal as we would think. But yet they could pop in and pop out simply by putting on and off their virtual reality apparatus. And as such, if they come down here, they can appear human and yet not be human. They can come and go. All that we have described, however, is the nature of their presence in this world and universe at the time and moment of their manifestation. We have made no statement whatsoever about their actual form and presence in a higher dimensional plane in a different universe. And that is the great distinction that we must make here. You see, there are those who hold that races of angels have forms and bodies, physical bodies, but not physical by our definition, but physical in a different way. We say, as Rambam himself will enumerate later, that there are four elements that make up the physical creation. We generally call them fire, air, water, and earth, which represent, of course, energy state, gaseous state, liquid state, solid state. We human beings are made up of all four. And it's said that angels are made up of two, fire and air, energy and gas. Can there be beings that have bodies made of energy? Don't be so quick to dismiss it, because many of our sages say, yes, indeed, that is what an angel really is. But for Rambam, when he states here that they have no golem, klal, meaning they have no physical body like us, that would comply. That would be in complete agreement with what he's saying. You see, these entities aren't flesh and blood like us, but yet they can come and appear as flesh and blood like us. They can come into your house and shake your hand and eat your food, just like was the example of Avraham Avinu, when he had the three angels visiting him. Just like with the angel who came to visit Manoach, the father and mother of Samson, announcing his presence, and then he went up in a puff of smoke, beamed up, kind of like in a Star Trek episode. Went from physical corporeal reality to his original state. They live in a dimensional ability wherein which these things are possible. These are higher consciousnesses. They have existed for, how we measure time, millions and possibly billions of years before us. Our sages say that races of angels were created on the second day of creation and others on the fifth day of creation. Being that we know these days are actual epochs of time as opposed to just 24-hour periods, these races have been around by what, for our definition, again, is millions or billions of years. How do they evolve? I don't know. They might be similar to artificial intelligent computer programs that have just been around forever. They've been programmed. They said, this is what you are, this is what we do, and that's it. So be it. But these higher races do exist. And they exist in a very different format and structure than what we know and understand. That is the nature of what Rambam here is trying to tell us. We have physical construct forms that come and go. Physical construct forms that are relatively permanent. And then non-physical, non-construct forms. which still exist, but not within the context and concept of our definition of physicality. These are the three levels. This is, if you will, an introduction to these higher races. They are called God's messengers, in that they are obviously one with the Torah, one with Hashem, and serve to bring, to be the conduit, to shine the energy and the light of the primordial existence through the different avenues and vehicles that they represent and they control. And these messengers do their job. We call that Hebrew word malach, which means a messenger, and it gets translated into English as angel. Ultimately, anyone who is a messenger for God, shining the light, doing the work, is God's messenger. The winds are God's messenger, as is the water, as is every lesson in life, as you and I can be, if we so chose to, by surrendering and bonding to the higher principle. So, Be'ezrat Hashem, I'm going to stop here, because when we proceed in our next lesson, we're going to discuss more about angels, how the prophets saw them, the types of bodies and form, what it means, and then, God be willing, we will enumerate the different species of angels, the different forms that they can take and interrelationships that we can have. And then Rambam is going to reveal to us some deeper and more profound revelations. So on this note, let us conclude. Baruch Adonai Lo'olam.